There were two artists on the island when I moved on here, just two. And then Carla Matzke and I moved on in 1994. Now there was four artists on the island.
It's Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is artist Jack Gunter. The island he's talking about is Kameno, snug between Whidbey and the mainland. It wasn't much of a cultural destination in the 90s, which is when our story begins.
And one day, I got a visit from Reverend Chumley, whose name is Michael Melnick.
Well, my stage name is Reverend Chumley, and if you haven't heard that name, you wonder, what does he mean by reverend?
And he's a vaudevillian.
Well, I lack the personal ethics to be a pornographer, which only left religion as a duplicitous way to make money.
He's friends with the Flying Karamazov brothers, and he gets shot out of cannons and did a vaudeville theater for a living for quite a few years.
Is it accurate that you have been shot out of a cannon on more than one occasion?
With a smoke bomb in my pants and doing that held by the audience.
He was such an innovative character that I believe he went to the first meeting with a giant donkey head.
My specialties are doing stuff that are both silly and dangerous appearing.
So he came out and said, Jack, I went to a meeting of the Chamber of Commerce the other day, and there's these three old gals that don't even have a business, and they're just sort of holding the charter together for the chamber because someone's got to be there.
This chamber was largely consisting of people with little businesses that wanted to make themselves feel more relevant to Kameno.
And I bet if we got a bunch of artists, we could take over the Chamber of Commerce and have it run by the artist community.
I convinced some of the artists like Jack Gunter and some other of the artists that the chamber needed redoing. It would give us some official imprimatur on our troublemaking, benign troublemaking.
So we went to the meeting and these three gals said, oh, thank God some young people are here. And within a month, they left and we became the chamber.
What happens when a bunch of mischievous artists take over a business group? Could this possibly end well? Today on Sound Effect, our theme is Friend or Foe? Stories of the blurry line between ally and adversary. So, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, right? Kind of a civic booster club geared toward local businesses. I'm sure there are plenty of cutting-edge chambers out there, but fair to say the stereotype of them is kind of square.
People who believe that history, growth, and traditional values can work together.
It's a city that has struck a unique balance between the needs of people and the needs of business.
Welcome to tradition. Welcome to the Catskills.
So when Jack Gunter and Reverend Chumley and their band of merry pranksters took over the Kameno Island Chamber, the changes came fast.
The first thing that we decided was that we wanted no new businesses. And that seemed to be counterproductive for the Chamber of Commerce.
And the meetings were great because there were only artists and we drank wine. And I'm not going to say we smoked pot, but I'm not going to say we didn't.
I was the president one year and I ran three meetings stoned, which I'm actually quite comfortable doing. And I did a great job.
But this new chamber wasn't all play and no work. After all, artists and gallery owners are small businesses, too. Before long, the purists, like Reverend Chumley, started to lose interest.
And so they immediately stopped smoking pot. They started drinking wine at the end of the meeting. And the people who were in the business end of things who started joining up back then weren't very fun. And I'm the one who restarted it, but I bailed on it soon.
But meanwhile, Gunter and crew set about doing what chambers of commerce do, marketing their community. Only in this case, it was all about branding Kameno as an art town.
And so we started slowly suggesting that Kameno Island was a place where artists lived. And it's sort of like the Field of Dreams, because there was only six of us now. And we called it a Northwest Masterpiece. That's how we branded the island.
A couple years later, in 1999, their attention was drawn to a chunk of land that was anything but a masterpiece.
I'll explain the island. It's about 17 miles long, sort of shaped like a pickle. And you drive over a bridge from Stanwood, you're faced with a split in the road where you can go west all the way down the west side, or you can go east at that point, which is called Terry's Corner.
The chamber owned a sliver of it and had a little kiosk set up as a welcome center, but the artists saw something grander.
Now, Terry's Corner, when I moved onto the island, was a big sand pit, just a big eyesore.
It was just a dumping ground. It was a place to stop and get rid of your empty bottles and take a whiz and then head on down the island. It was pretty grim.
Jack Archibald is a Kameno glass artist.
We would go up here and just fantasize what it would be like to to get a little bit of this. And we asked them if we could just take to here.
Gunter and his crew talked the owners of the property into ceding a chunk of it to the chamber. The vision was for a new visitor center showcasing the island's artists. And eventually, the big dream, turn the derelict property into an art and sculpture park.
Well, what we got here is really about a 10 by 12 building that's probably 15, 16 feet tall.
We got free roofing from Esri Roofing. We got free flooring that was bamboo flooring, all given away free. We basically built that whole building for nothing.
But this was just a little place to keep brochures and have somebody that volunteers to, you know, give directions and maps and talk about Camino Island.
Jack Archibald made a 16-foot stained glass window, which he donated.
Got a lot of color to it. And like I was telling you before, it wasn't particularly well received. We've had bullet hole. You can see a bullet hole there. You can see a bullet hole up here. They threw bottles at it. We had a lot of vandalism, and I don't get that very often.
But plenty of people did like it. It was eye-catching and modern. They beautified the area right around it, and they began placing sculptures. A mastodon here, a totem pole there. Jack Archibald says the project drew him further and further in and made the culture clash between the artists and the old-time chamber hands pretty much inevitable.
I didn't go to the first meetings. I'm distrustful of Chamber of Commerce, and I still am, to be honest. But at some point I realized if we're going to get this done, I have to join the chamber and join the board and have a vote. It was a pretty contentious group. I think they really didn't like the artists, and I think vice versa was sort of true, too. Like I said, I don't want to overplay how much animosity there was, but it was obviously there. I mean, the little sculpture here, I remember one time they wanted to know if we were going to have water coming out its butt. And I said, no, it's not going to have water coming. I mean, that's how nasty it got at the end. They felt like they'd been co-opted. And in a sense, they had been co-opted, but for good purposes.
After a few years, the park was well established, and the artists had their gateway to the island. More than that, Camino had become a true art destination. Its annual Mother's Day studio tour features more than 30 studios and galleries and draws visitors in the thousands. The Great Camino Chamber Coup had arguably accomplished its goals. One by one, most of the artists dropped out of the chamber and let it revert back to the island's business community. And to the troublemakers involved, the most lasting legacy may be the spirit of community that emerged from this chapter of Camino history.
My biggest memory is how many people were involved in this. Even though some of it was contentious, the truth is, you know, a lot of people came together and donated time and money and effort. And it kind of inspired me a little bit to do more. I was just getting going on my own glass. And now I try to donate glass to any public building that comes in.
It seems like this has turned you into a fully civic-minded guy.
I hate to admit it, Gabriel. I think it did. Yeah, I think it did.
I'm proud of a lot of things I've done. I'm proud of a lot of things I've created. But I think that I'm most proud in the whole world of my role in building a beautiful entry to Camino Island. By locals who had no political affiliations and no agendas. We just wanted to accomplish something, and I can't believe that a bunch of yahoos from South Camino pulled this whole thing off.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and our theme today is Friend or Foe. The first time Matt Griffin went to Afghanistan, it was in combat gear. Griffin was an elite fighter with the Army Rangers, going on missions to remote and dangerous mountain regions. These days, Griffin goes to Afghanistan as a business person. He's the co-founder and CEO of Combat Flip Flops. They make, yes, flip flops. It's a for-profit business with income and expenses and spreadsheets, but it also has an important social mission, using the tools of war to try and manufacture peace. Griffin joined us to explain how it all came to be, starting at the beginning.
Ever since I was a little boy, all I wanted to do was be an Army Ranger, jump out of airplanes, and you know, live the life. I mean, we grew up under the G.I. Joe era in the 80s and be all that you can be, get an edge on life in the Army, that whole thing. Yeah. Yeah. So I drank that Kool-Aid. And in 1997, I went to West Point and I graduated in 2001. And then September 11th happened a few short months after that. I mean, everybody's life changed.
So tell me about your first deployment.
It was called Operation Winter Strike. So this is a very famous deployment within the Ranger Regiment within Special Operations, but they deployed us to Nuristan, which is the border of Pakistan, really high altitude mountain villages, and they sent us there to rout out all the Al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters from their winter safe havens and high altitude mountain villages. And so we drove the trucks as far as they would go. We got in helicopters and took them as far as they would go. And then we started walking. And it was eye-opening to live in those villages and see the absolute poverty. I mean, they're farmers and families, and they just do whatever they can to survive. And then, you know, people float across the border and they have guns and they say, hey, we're going to give you $600 to farm this opium. And if you don't, we're going to come back, we're going to kill your family. And so what option do they have?
So how did you come to think during your time on that deployment and subsequently about what your relationship as a member of the military was to the people who lived in this country where you're fighting?
I really didn't think too much about it, to be honest. You know, we were in special operations. We have a job to do. It involves very intense focus. But I have to say my fourth deployment in Iraq was probably the one that solidified it. And, you know, we're the top dogs, right? And there's just no other way to say it. Like, if we're going to go after somebody, we're going to go get them. And we're a national level asset, which means we operate under the top tiers of the military or the White House. And we were going out and we were catching these kids. And like, literally, they're 14, 15-year-old kids with hand grenades and pistols. And, you know, it came to a realization to me that, you know, we are putting our service members in danger. We're spending our national assets to catch these youth that are just coming in from everywhere. And as long as we're over there in an armed capacity and women are giving birth to children, we're always going to have an enemy. Like, we're cutting the head off the serpent. This is an endless cycle that we're in. And so I didn't really know what we could do. There was no answer at the time.
So how did you even approach that question for yourself?
I did what I called emptied my karma cup, I believe, in service. And so I knew that I had to fill it back up. And I started working for a company out of Seattle called Remote Medical International. And I was the government sales manager, and I started traveling to war zones to put in clinics in support of government contractors working overseas. And when I was there, I saw businesses providing the best security and the best freedom for the people that were there. And I kept seeing this in Africa and Asia and throughout the Middle East. Long story, but I ended up in a combat boot factory in Afghanistan. I saw 300 people working, and I found out that they were going to go out of work when the war ended, and I wanted to do something to keep them employed. So we started a company making flip-flops in their factory.
And why flip-flops?
Because you don't really feel like fighting when you're in flip-flops.
Say more.
Like our tagline is bad for running, worse for fighting. Like, when you throw on flip-flops, you are making a conscious decision that you are not going to get into a fight. You know, we're taking, this is the literal transformation of swords to plowshares. You know, it was like also the political term of it too. Like, a flip-flop is somebody who takes a 180-degree stance change on a subject while argues that both are still needed. Like, we were at the top end of special operations, you know, doing armed conflict on behalf of our country. And now we're going to go to the other side and say, nope, what we need to do is we need to do more business peacefully, but both are still needed. And so, like, the whole word, everything else all fit together. And it was fun.
So how did you start?
in my kitchen with my brother Andy and my Ranger buddy Lee. And we guerrilla flip-flopped a trade show in January 2012. Some bloggers wrote about it, and we sold 4,000 pair almost overnight. And unbeknownst to us, because we had been focused on building a company, but the administration had announced the end of the Afghan war in 2014. Go figure, right? And so right as we were launching our company, all of the boot contracts for the factories that we were going to use got pulled. And
so they were going to be in parallel, kind of?
They were going to be in parallel. Like, yeah, if they had a break in the combat boot run, they were going to manufacture flip-flops, you know, to keep the factory line running. And then hopefully over time, we would grow our product line, and then flip-flops would grow, and then boots would go out. Mm-hmm. Right? So it was just going to take time. And so we launched the company in January of 2012. We had a June delivery, which then got delayed into July, which then got delayed into August. And then Andy, my brother, and I went down to that surplus store down near the Starbucks headquarters on First. And we bought as many duffel bags as we possibly could, and then went to SeaTac Airport and flew to Kabul to go pick them up. And we got there and we found that they were, you know, thousands of pairs of beautifully assembled flip-flops out of bad materials. So our manufacturer of the raw materials had done a few things and we missed the quality assurance of it, and we couldn't ship them home. You know, people were paying $70 for these flip-flops. They maybe look like $10 flip-flops. And so you just can't do that as a company. So we opened the doors and gave them all away, wrote our customers and said, hey, like, the footwear's bad. We'll figure this out. We found another factory. I leveraged every credit card I had, and I maxed out everything that I could, and I bought 4,000 more pair of flip-flops myself. And then as those materials got finished, the factory in Afghanistan, the second factory we ran to work with, closed. So we ended up shipping the container to my house, and we built a Gorilla flip-flop factory in my garage in Issaquah, Washington. And with the help of friends and family, we manufactured 4,000 pair of flip-flops.
How? So when you're making the decision to do that, wasn't there a voice in your head being like, hey, man, maybe you should do something else?
All the time. There always is, but it's weird how our company works. Like, the positive emails we get from our customers are unbelievable. We had 4,000 people, and we said, hey, your flip-flops are bad. We're not going to be able to deliver them for at least another 7 months. And we had 3 people ask for a refund. Everything else was positive affirmation. Hey, you guys are awesome. Keep at it. We know you guys are going to get this sorted. And we're just thankful for their support. And we call them the unarmed forces.
Do you think of this in any way as a repudiation of your earlier life as an Army Ranger?
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned earlier that I think that I emptied my karma cup when I was in the military, and I'm doing my best to fill it back up. And it feels good. You know, everything operates in balance in life. And I broke a lot of things and destroyed a lot of things when I was younger, and I'm doing my best to build them back up. And my team, a lot of members of my team, feel the same way too.
You must have plenty of military friends or ex-military friends. Did they understand kind of where you're coming from?
Oddly enough, the military and the military community has been the biggest supporters of our mission, because it's really hard for most Westerners and Americans to be empathetic to the struggles that a lot of these cultures go through just because they haven't been there. So when, you know, we came out and we said, hey, like, we're providing jobs, we're employing women, we're using our funds to educate little girls in Afghanistan, the military guys go, yep, that's what we should have been doing in those communities the whole time. I'm going to buy your product to support that.
So have you seen people wearing your flip-flops out in the wild?
Yeah, that is one of the fun things when we see people wearing our stuff out in the wild. I'll actually, like, almost spear tackle them in an airport. And I'll just, hey, come here, I want to take a selfie with you. And then they're like, what? It's like, your flip-flops. And then they go, oh, those are your flip-flops. Like, yeah, come here. And then they'll end up on our Instagram account. I love it.
Matt Griffin is co-founder and CEO of Combat Flip Flops, based in Issaquah. After the setbacks with the Afghan factory, Griffin and his team concluded the logistics of making flip-flops there were just too tough. They decided to move production to Colombia, another country that's experienced conflict. Combat Flip Flops did eventually find a product that was easier to make in Afghanistan, scarves. They also make jewelry from unexploded landmines left over from the Vietnam War. Portions of the proceeds go to educating girls in Afghanistan, removing landmines around the world, and helping U.S. Special Operations Forces with the return home. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today on Sound Effect is Friend or Foe. Around the year 2000, Gregory Utes had a lunch date. The guy he was meeting was kind of a big deal.
Well, I was quite nervous, because here's this historical figure. I mean, I had read his book before I'd met him, so I was aware of what a huge, towering figure he was, both in China and in the United States.
Utes is a professor of music and a China expert at Pacific Lutheran University, and his lunch date was Sidney Rittenberg.
And I think we went over to a little Italian restaurant right off campus here. I wasn't quite sure what to make of it, but he ordered spaghetti and meatballs. That was his favorite thing. And that kind of did it. I mean, that kind of brought him right down to earth.
Sidney Rittenberg spent much of the last century at the center of Chinese history. The revolutions, upheavals, the massive social reorganization. He also experienced things that would break most people. Persecution, trauma, torture. But Rittenberg somehow came out of it as a guy who likes to make jokes over spaghetti and meatballs.
He just loved puns and jokes and sarcasm. I mean, he's just a funny, funny man.
Sidney Rittenberg's life story is an epic. There's much more than we can relate here.
He grew up in a Jewish family in Charleston, South Carolina, and from the start, he was drawn to confronting injustice. He got involved in student activism and labor organizing. He later joined the army during World War II, learned Chinese, and shipped off to China in 1944. But just as the World War was ending, China's civil war was ramping up. Rittenberg fell in with underground members of the Communist Party. They encouraged him to trek across the country to Yan'an, where the communist rebels were holed up. Paul Manfredi is a Chinese studies professor at PLU and another friend of Rittenberg's.
When he first went, he, I don't believe, had plans to stay for very long, and that changed.
In Yan'an, Rittenberg found a kind of communist utopia. It seemed like there was a real chance to build a more just society. And then came his first fateful meeting with the rebels' famous leader, Mao Zedong. Rittenberg described it in the documentary The Revolutionary from Starwater Pictures.
I met Mao for the first time on the day I arrived in Yan'an. I walked in the door and there he was. And I thought, it's like a picture right out of history. Here's a picture out of history. Here's the man that's on the walls. That's what I was thinking. And underneath that was the feeling, and I'm now part of that history.
Sidney was drawn to Mao's intellect and idealism, and Mao in turn was intrigued by this foreigner, seemingly sympathetic to the cause. So the rebels invited Rittenberg to stick around.
And I said I would be overjoyed to stay. My one request would be that if I stay, I would like to be admitted to the Chinese Party.
Sidney Rittenberg became the first American to join the Chinese Communist Party. And this was just as hostilities with the ruling nationalist forces were starting to boil over.
He had to ask himself, do I really want to die for this cause? Because bombs are literally falling out of the sky. He realized the people around him were so completely committed that I think it was a bit infectious. I think he decided this is a chance to change the world.
If you put one drop into the long river of human history, that's immortal. That goes on wave after wave, drop after drop, long after you know it or don't know it. So you either make a difference or you don't make a difference, in which case you're just a piece of mud that's swept away and doesn't matter. But you can matter.
Through the late 40s, the communist armies gained ground, and Rittenberg started taking on important jobs. He'd translate party writings into English and consult with Mao about the West. His prominence got him some unwelcome attention from the Soviet Union. In fact, Joseph Stalin himself denounced him, along with several other foreigners. And soon Rittenberg got a knock at the door. He was under arrest, accused of spying for the U.S.
The room spun round and round, just spun round and round. And I saw stars shooting all over the place. And I just shock, you know, just terrific shock.
He was simply put in a dark room basically for a year. So it was not only solitary confinement, but it was pitch black. And this was, of course, psychological torture.
He was physically tortured, too, he'd later write, including being force-fed drugs.
You know, every day is miserable because you're alone, but you're not really alone, because every day you're sitting there with your own potential madness sitting across from you, watching you, and you know it's either you or him.
He was certain that this had been just a mistake. After that year, a party official visited him and brought hope that Rittenberg might be accepted back into the good graces of the party. He offered to take the boards off the windows, get him a desk and books.
And you can stay here and study until your case is solved. Or you can just forget about China for the rest of your life and go back to America. We'll let you go back. And I said, I'll stay here and study.
After making that extraordinary choice to stay, Rittenberg's case dragged on. He was held in prison for 5 more years. In 1955, another whiplash series of events. He was released, rehabilitated, and promoted. In the riptide of revolutionary politics, Rittenberg found himself in charge of a major party propaganda organ, Radio Beijing. He married a young party member named Wang Yulin, had children, and soaked in Chinese culture.
So I think those were the glory years for Sidney, personally, romantically, in terms of being a father, and just this feeling that I've really arrived, I'm doing what I came to China to do.
Many injustices are being committed in the name of the Communist Project, and he obviously doesn't want to be a party to those, and I think believes he can avoid any kind of abuse of power, but that becomes increasingly difficult as time goes on.
Rittenberg admits turning a blind eye at times, and even participating in the harassment of intellectuals.
I think the reason I couldn't see it was wrong was largely because I was living a privileged life. I wasn't paying attention. I wasn't feeling what happened to other people. Otherwise, I think I would have seen it. So it's a kind of corruption. And that's exactly, I think, the kind of corruption that ruins the whole thing once you get into power.
It came to a head in the mid-1960s with what's now known as the Cultural Revolution. The country's youth were encouraged to challenge the established leadership. It was very messy, and other foreigners kept their distance, but Rittenberg joined one of the youth factions.
The question is always, how could anybody have thought that was a good idea? So, Sidney, how could you have thought that was a good idea? You know, he was the one who really explained to me how at the very early days it was possible for someone to believe that the Cultural Revolution was in fact an invitation to the people to reestablish their authority in a really kind of democratic way.
Instead, it would become a bloodbath.
It was a catastrophe of historic proportions. You could only compare it to a catastrophe like the Holocaust in Europe.
By 1968, Rittenberg's faction was on the outs, and his position became precarious again.
You know, one day I have my picture taken in a group photo with Mao, and 2 weeks later the picture's reprinted in another paper and I'm blacked out.
Rittenberg was arrested again. Once more he was sent to solitary confinement. This time his sentence lasted nearly 10 years. He was finally released in 1977, chastened and disillusioned. 3 years later, he and his family left China for the United States. And that's where yet another extraordinary chapter of his life began. He bought a home on Fox Island near Tacoma. He started teaching at Pacific Lutheran University. He began a consulting business advising U.S. companies on China. It was not exactly communism, but Rittenberg still believed in working toward friendship with China.
We call Papa Sidney godfather of U.S.-China relations.
This is Zhu Tong, chief commercial officer at the Port of Tacoma and a close friend of Rittenberg. At her wedding, he gave her away.
He was my papa. He still is my papa forever.
Zhu and Rittenberg connected over a mutual acquaintance. Zhu's uncle had briefly served as the Chinese Minister of Culture in the 1960s before falling out of favor. Like Rittenberg, he too was imprisoned in solitary confinement. Zhu says her uncle was traumatized by it.
I can't help but wonder, if he didn't have that experience, where would he be today? My uncle is a very talented man, but the spirit has been broken a bit.
It's not surprising that years of solitary confinement would leave scars. What is surprising is that Sidney Rittenberg seemed to emerge not only intact, but still full of vigor and humor and idealism.
Even though he had gone through such hardship and yet emerged in such a positive way is just amazing to me. I have never heard him complain.
Gregory Utes from PLU has thought a lot about his friend's resilience through those dark years in prison. He attributes it in part to Sidney's humor and compassion. He'd joke with the prison guards and ask about their families. But there was something else, too.
He also had a very strong sense of self-discipline. You know, every day he would clean his cell as if there was anything to clean. He would have periods of the day when he would do certain mental work. Today I shall remember what I remember of Herodotus or Plato. You're not going to give in to the madness that's staring you in the face across the cell. So inside this humorous, compassionate, lovely man is this backbone of steel that I frankly don't understand.
Sidney Rittenberg died in 2019 at age 98, having come to believe that Mao Zedong was both a great historic leader and a great historic criminal. He regretted his role in some of the darker parts of China's struggles. But he never backed away from his determination to add to the long river of human history.
I remember saying to Yulin, when I first started getting involved, I said, you know, I may end up covered with mud from head to foot, but if anything was ever worth it, this is it.
Special thanks to Lucy Ostrander, along with Irv Drasnin and Don Sellers, for material from their film, The Revolutionary. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is friend or foe. Our DNA is closely tied up with who we are. Every cell in your body contains identical copies of the blueprint for you. Well, not every cell. In each of us, there's a small number of cells with someone else's DNA. These exotic cells mostly come from our mothers, and if you're a mother yourself, from your children. And those cells aren't just sitting there, they seem to affect our health, for better or worse. To help get our heads around what that means, we talked with Dr. J. Lee Nelson. She's a faculty member at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in the University of Washington, and she says this cell-swapping phenomenon is called microchimerism.
So microchimerism, the word derives from the root word is chimera, which in mythology was a being that was part goat, part lion, and part serpent. But in medicine, what it means is harboring cells or DNA that came from a genetically different person.
It makes sense that a mother, a pregnant mother and her fetus exchange nutrients and fluids and antibodies and stuff like that. But you're saying they also exchange intact cells.
Yeah, why not?
So what does that mean for, I guess, each member of that exchange?
As a general principle, I think if you have a pregnancy that's normal and goes to term, it gives benefit. But is there our job as physician scientists to kind of look for both? So how can we harness the benefit and how can we learn what we can learn to try to treat people better if we think these cells are actually being part of the problem?
Let's talk about the mechanics a little bit. Like when and where does it happen?
So we know we find them in the pancreas, we know we find them in the liver, we know we find them in the spleen, we know we find them in the renal tubular cells, we know we find them in circulating blood cells. And in the experimental studies, there are some experimental studies that have shown that the cells can traffic to a site of injury. And they've looked in the direction mostly of fetal cells or cells of fetal origin in a mom. Or in a, whatever you call the mother mouse. but showing that at certain times of injury that the fetal cells would traffic to the site of injury, you know, presumably to try to be additive to repair.
Yeah. So, but if I were going to watch a movie of one of these cells going, tell me if I've got it right. So the cell, let's say a fetal cell sloughs off in the course of development. It somehow makes its way across the placenta into the mother's body or whatever, into the rest of the mother's body, circulates around. Some of these cells are going to be stem cells. And where they land, they kind of like take root and found little lines of whatever, renal cells or brain cells or blood cells.
Well said. Yeah.
And it goes the other way too?
And it goes the other way too. And the kind of the way I visualize it, as you say that, because you're bringing a visual image, is almost like, okay, the umbilical cord's going to get severed, cut. But here's a little, it's like a snow flurry gift.
And I'm sorry, what is a snow flurry gift?
That's just a kind of a visual image of the cells of a...
Just going...
The cells coming over, yeah. There is data showing at least as early as the second trimester that you can find maternal cells in the fetus.
Are there any other ways that show that, you know, inheriting or rather receiving, I guess, cells from, say, your mother during pregnancy might benefit your health?
Yes. And I think this is a really interesting area. Overall, I would say the model that I have is I think that the maternal cells aren't, they're small in number, micro means small in number. So they aren't directly taking over, but they're instructing you. So they'll instruct you as to what is dangerous and a threat, and you should react to it and make a lot of inflammation, and what is not dangerous and not a threat. So the nice illustration of that is a paper by a woman who worked with me, Whitney Harrington, and she studied women who were pregnant and had malaria while they were pregnant. And the children born to those women are known to actually have an increased chance of being diagnosed with malaria.
That does not sound good.
No, and you would think, well, why didn't the mom protect the kid? But what Whitney found is that the children are much less likely, the ones that have the maternal cells, they're much less likely to actually be symptomatic from the malaria. And so it's in essence, this is like as if the mother is instructing you saying, look, you know, these mosquitoes are everywhere. I cannot protect you from this malaria, but let me show you how not to die.
Wow. Something in those cells contains information or provokes an immune response that makes the kid better able to kind of weather the storm. And even though they might be infected, they're not going to get sick.
Yep.
That's wild.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful.
Incidentally, does it go across more than, one or two generations at a time? Could I have grandparental and even more ancient cells of, you know, distinct genetic origin in my body?
Probably so. It hasn't been formally proven, but I do happen to know with a colleague that there is evidence for grand maternal.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then how would transmission among siblings happen?
So that would be, you're born, your mom is carrying cells from you, and then she becomes pregnant with your younger sister. And because some of her cells are, your mom's cells are going to reach the younger sister, and they contain some of yours. Occasionally, we would think this happens. It doesn't look like it's real common in the initial data that we have, but I think it does happen.
Do we have any sense of why nature might have designed us to do this?
I think it's a great plan. I mean, would you really want to go it alone?
Kind of.
Yeah.
I feel a lot more comfortable with just my own genes. Thank you.
But I say, you know, the Beatles song, I get by with a little help from my friends, right? Why not? And if you think about it from an evolutionary point of view, why wouldn't you want to benefit from as much information as you can get over time?
So that's interesting. So the genetic information is not only telling the cell what to be, it is carrying information about a history and environment and so on, and in a sense putting that into the baby or whoever's getting the cell.
Yeah.
If you had unlimited time and money, what are the big questions that you'd be most excited to chip away at an answer for?
On the practical side, I don't think we're that far from asking, how can we harness the potential of naturally acquired cells to our benefit? And should we target these cells when we think they're a problem? So, for example, there are several papers that show women who've given birth to a child with Down syndrome, that mother is at increased risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Okay, if you're harboring a genetically abnormal cell over decades and they reach the brain, that could be a problem. And if that connection is made, there's no reason you need those cells. So we could target those and prevent that.
It's all so much less straightforward than Bob McLean told me in biology class in ninth grade.
But it's beautiful because it's more like music, right? I mean, but biology is not it's not so linear.
And you do find beauty in that.
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
What's a piece of music that you think would be a good way to end this interview?
So we have been acquiring songs of microchimerism. And so it starts with songs like I'm in You and You're in Me by Peter Frampton, right? And then we've got the Beatles. One of theirs is I Am You and You Are Me. right? Because these cells differentiate. So we now have about 30 to 35, and we're looking for more to increase our repertoire of songs. I'm in
you. You're in me. That's Dr. J. Lee Nelson of the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center and the University of Washington. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Friend or Foe. Back in the late 80s, Melissa Reeves was all smiles. She was getting ready to move from Michigan to San Diego, where she could enjoy the sunshine and palm trees. And she had what she thought was a really wonderful boyfriend named Bill. But when it was time to move, Bill was a no-show.
He totally ghosted me. He completely dumped me on the day that I was moving into this new apartment. So I was really upset. And I remember that little voice in my head said, "Girl, you got it. Don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. You're going to be just fine."
But it was hard to listen to that voice. Her heart was broken. And so Melissa decided to go seek out some answers. And the person she turned to was a fortune teller. She picks up the story from here.
I found her in this ad that was in the back of the Reader newspaper, and her name was Sonia. And I walked into her parlor, and it was very, very dimly lit, and it smelled like stale incense and fresh desperation. And she looked at me with these coal brown eyes, and she was about my age. She wasn't really that far away from me in age, but she knew exactly what to do. So she pulls out these cards, and she starts pulling my love card, and then she pulls my finance card, and then she stops, and she goes, "Oh, you have a curse." What? She's like, "You have a curse. You've had one for a couple hundred years here." And I'm like, "Well, my God, what do we do?" She's like, "Well, you will never have love or money until we get this curse removed." I'm like, "What?" And so she tells me now that I have to come back 3 days later and have a brown paper bag stuffed with $600 and an egg. I'm like, "An egg?" And she's like, "Don't question me. I have to get rid of this curse." So I come back like a stupid dog, and I plunk this Ralph's paper bag, Ralph's groceries, on the table, and it's got everything in it. And she says, "Okay, now just sit there in your wickedness and shut your eyes." And so I'm shutting my eyes, and I can hear her kind of rustling around, but all I can think about is what the heck I had done to get this curse. So I'm thinking I had maybe, you know, abandoned a war wound buddy in the trenches, or maybe a couple hundred years ago I told the French that they could eat cake. Like, what did I do? And then she says, "Okay, now you can open your eyes." And before me is this like completely terrifying sight. The egg is now in a bowl, cracked, and there's blood in the yolk. And I'm like, "Oh my God." She goes, "That is your curse. That is your family curse right there. And now everything in that bag is contaminated with that curse." And she goes, "I know what to do." And she says, "I will bury that bag under a tree at midnight by a river, and that will take your curse away and you'll be fine. But everything in it is bad." And I said, "Even the money?" She goes, "Of course the money. Do not be ridiculous." So I'm like, "Okay, thank you so much." And so I actually go and book another appointment with her for the following week, because I figure, okay, if the curse is gone now, let's get back to business. Let's get Bill back, right? So we part ways, and I come back a week later. And, you know, I think I am feeling a little, I've convinced myself I feel less cursey. And I sit down and we have our session and it's okay, but she looks really good. I mean, she's dressed to the nines. She's wearing this fire engine red outfit from head to toe, totally stunning. And I'm driving home and I'm thinking, "What? This just didn't feel right." And then that little voice started talking a little louder this time. And it said, "Doesn't Nordstrom have their half yearly sale going on right about now? And didn't $600 just kind of plunk into her lap?" And I'm like, "I've been duped. How could that happen? I am an educated woman. How? Oh my God. And so, in shock, I just go home and I pick up the phone and I call her. And I'm like, how could you do that? Why did you do that? She's like, what? No, no, no. We do this. My family's been doing this for generations. I'm like, really? I want to hear a little bit more about this. So tomorrow, I want you to meet me at the office. And you're going to tell me about this, okay? Because I want to learn. So the next day, she shows up. And I go into this conference room with her and sit her down. And she starts telling me about what they do. But I have a little Walkman stuffed in my pocket, and I have it on and recording. And she's going on about how her family does this, blah, blah, blah. And I remember as I was looking at her, I could see that she wasn't really that proud of herself. She's in this family business that she can't get out of. She can't even find the keys to it. And then she'd look at me and see all this hope and all this bright future that I'd have in front of me. And that wasn't in her cards. And so I think that's why she could do that. That's how she did that over and over and over again. I took that tape and I brought it to the police. And the San Diego police were so grateful because they had been trying to bust this psychic family ring for 40 years. 40 years. There are people that they would never come forward because they were so embarrassed, right? It's so embarrassing. You're like, how could I be that stupid? It's something that's played on people who are usually very vulnerable. They're brokenhearted, they're elderly and lonely, or they might be sick, and this is something that could give them hope. And people have had tens of thousands and even millions of dollars taken from them under this trick. If that had not happened, I think I would have gone longer being naive. I also noticed that I don't have to have Bill, but I think the most important, valuable thing that I learned was listen to that little voice. And when I listen to it, I'm fine. I'm good. Irony is that 15 years after all this goes down, I'm now living here in Seattle, and I'm sitting at the office at my desk, phone rings, and it's Bill. He actually called out of the blue, tracked me down just to apologize for breaking up with me without cause, which I thought was kind of sweet that he'd been tormented. And so I forgave him, of course, because I realized he wasn't in my cards.
Melissa Reeves is a public speaking coach, storyteller, and professional improviser in Seattle. She said that in the end, she did end up getting her money back. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. We had help this week from Paul Currington of Fresh Ground Stories and Kari Ploeg. Thanks again to Starwater Pictures for the use of their film The Revolutionary. You can find out more about it on our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. We're back next week with the theme, Let's Eat. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.